Welcome to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm one of the hosts, Cody Cook, and before I was welcome to join the Libertarian Christian Podcast, I recorded an occasional podcast of my own called Cantus Firmus. I was able to book some great guests and have some excellent conversations there that are relevant to the intersection of faith and freedom. So I'd like to share some of those conversations for you to enjoy. This is one of them, and I hope you appreciate it as much as I did.
Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You are watching or listening to Cantus Firmus. My guest today is Gregory Baus, and I didn't check the pronunciation. I assume that it's pronounced like house, B-A-U-S. Is that correct?
Correct. Like okay. Strauss.
Yeah. Okay. German name?
It is. Yes. Okay. The Bauses are from Baden.
Interesting. And yet you're the one who's arguing as a Reformed person today, and I'm the one arguing as an Anabaptist.
Yeah.
So Greg is a colleague at the Libertarian Christian Institute, where he co-hosts the Reformed Libertarians podcast, and I'm just a lowly contributor. Greg, can you tell me about your work with LCI just a little bit, Libertarian Christian Institute?
Sure. You know, I remember it probably just through an internet search, I became aware of the original Libertarian Christians blog by Norman Horn back in 2008, and I've been a reader and commenter on their various online forums since that time. I converted, so to speak, to libertarian anarchism in October 2008, having previously been a constitutional classical liberal. And I'd contacted Norm by email to see if he knew any other confessionally reformed libertarians. I've only written one article for the LCI website on the confessionally reformed view of Romans 13 and a stateless civil governance, originally published in 2019, I think. But after having written the Reformed Libertarianism Statement in 2020 with Carrie Baldwin, who's an LCI staff member, she and I were talking about collaborating on a podcast. And in the summer of 2022, LCI invited Carrie and I to co-host the LCI-sponsored Reformed Libertarians podcast. Right now, we have 15 regular episodes with more to come, Lord willing, and a website, reformedlibertarians.com. That has additional resources, and we're currently working on a forthcoming free ebook that reworks some existing transcripts and articles with some new material intended to introduce some of the key ideas of Reformed Libertarian Anarchism.
Great. And just kind of, I'm just going to throw this out here real quick. One of the things that's kind of interesting about LCI is it is kind of a broad cross-section of, well, at least say, evangelical Christianity. I'm not sure if there's much like Catholic representation or anything there. And so you and Carrie and I think Jacob Winograd, who hosts the Biblical Anarchy podcast, are kind of more in the Reformed camp. Is that correct? And so Doug Stewart, who's kind of the host of the main LCI podcast, and I think Norman Horn kind of go into that sort of more Arminian, what do they call that? Not Reconstructionist. That's really Reformed.
Restorationist.
Yeah.
Norm's a Church of Christ guy. Yeah.
And I think Doug had some background in that too, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So there's kind of, you know, some Arminians there and some, or those who are maybe not Calvinists, not Reformed, as well as some Reformed folks. And so we'll get into what these words mean a little bit if as we go on. But so basically, so I've got kind of a long, kind of winding backstory to why I have you on here, but I'll go ahead and start that now, and we'll get into it.
Yeah.
So this idea of Reformed Libertarianism is one I want to explore with you in more detail. So to give some background, there were different groups that came out of the Protestant Reformation in the early 1500s in Europe, those who were dissenting from the Roman Catholic views on certain things. And so we have major figures like Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli. And their movements are generally placed under the heading of the Magisterial Reformation. And you also had groups called Anabaptists, which largely made up the Radical Reformation. The Magisterial Reformation was unified in their rejection of Roman Catholic authority, but also in their affirmation of various other doctrines, some of which are broadly shared by Protestants today, For example, that scripture has unique authority that tradition doesn't, called sola scriptura, that salvation is by faith alone, etc. And so the Radical Reformation was more diverse at first, but it had coalesced into a collection of groups that held the separation from the state, a rejection of violence, a belief in free will, and a belief in believers-only baptism. And those are the views that are kind of mark Anabaptism today, that kind of Radical Reformation idea. So in these regards, they stood out from the magisterials who believed in, and maybe we'll get into whether this, if you think this word is the proper one to use, but sort of a union of church and state. They supported the use of violence to silence heretics, and they, or those they viewed as heretics, and not only taught infant baptism, but saw it as a means of maintaining Christian societies. So they sort of saw that, you know, if everyone in society was baptized, then that society was de facto Christian. Those who refused infant baptism, for instance, Jews and Anabaptists, were marked out by their refusal to be baptized, which made them outsiders who were not seen as true citizens. Contemporary Christian nationalists like Stephen Wolfe today argue that this kind of early Reformation Christianity should also animate the Christian nationalist movement. So he supports a Calvinist rejection of free will, depending on how one defines that. He supports infant baptism, and he supports a kind of unification of church and state wherein Christianity is promoted through state violence. So I'd sent you a draft of a paper I was working on where I was suggesting that Anabaptism's rejection of infant baptism, predestination, and state Christianity made sense in light of their general opposition to coercion or force in religion. That these three doctrines sort of invoke a force to some degree, and thus it makes sense that they were so central to the Magisterial Reformation's theology. They sort of do kind of fit together in a way that sort of seems logical. So my conclusion was that Anabaptist Christianity is more consistent with libertarian Christianity than Reformed Christianity is. But I wanted to run it by you first because you are a Reformed Christian, and as I said, a colleague at LCI. And so that's the long winding backstory of why I wanted to have you on. So maybe let's start with your analysis of my historical framing. Am I doing all right so far?
I would say it's pretty much in the ballpark.
Okay.
A few things I would say is that the magisterial reformers, I think, were largely opposed to, it was a real concern for them, was the earlier Anabaptist fanatical millenarianism. So they were seeking to establish the kingdom of God by violence. So these were not pacifists. The so-called German peasant revolts, mid-1520s, and the Munster Rebellion in the mid-1530s are probably the most prominent examples. And on church and state, the magisterial reformers, whether Lutheran or Reformed or what came to be known as Anglican, it's not so much that they held to a union of church and state as such, but having rejected the Roman doctrine of the church having ultimate temporal power, that is coercive power, they affirmed the fundamental difference between church and state in the variously expressed doctrine of the two kingdoms. But in any case, Reformed libertarians definitely acknowledge that not only Calvin, but the magisterial reformers generally believed and originally in the Reformed church standards confessed that it was the duty of the civil government or magistrates to coercively enforce at least external public religion and morality against non-aggressive public irreligion and immorality, generally known as the civil establishment of religion. You know, for a little bit more historical context, it might be of interest to note that Calvin was at odds with the city-state council of Geneva, his entire ministry, period of his ministry on a number of issues.
Just to break in really quickly. So sure. Calvin was living in Geneva. He had sort of pushed these reforms. And so some people would say that Calvin's Geneva was theocratic. And so what you're sort of saying is that it's a little more complicated than that, right?
Yeah. He was arguing for the full independence of the church, whereas the city council was perhaps more theocratic in the sense that they wanted civil government control over the church. And at one point early on, the council kicked him out along with Farrell and some others, or Farrell, however you say his name. They lived in, so they fled to Strasbourg, and, you know, in a way they considered him too radical. So he was fairly friendly, I would say, and solicitous of, or towards Anabaptists, at those he distinguished as peaceful and committed to the scriptures as the authority. When he was in Strasbourg, he publicly debated some Anabaptists. He joined a tailor's guild, which, as far as I understand, was some kind of social club and mutual aid society that had a majority Anabaptist membership, so he could more effectively interact with them. He won over a number of them, and he famously ended up marrying an ex-Anabaptist, whom by all accounts he loved dearly, and she was the widow of an ex-Anabaptist whom he had publicly debated and won over to the Reformed cause. So there's a little bit of history of his interaction with Anabaptists. On the point of free will, I'll say, as far as I know, all the magisterial reformers believed in free will. What they denied in terms of the sin bondage of the will was the spiritual ability of unregenerate or unconverted person's sinful will to genuinely trust and love God apart from God's grace. So they didn't deny free will as such. Rather, they held to a view of the unregenerate's spiritual inability. And this was basically a continuation of Augustinianism.
So just real quick, I'd like, this is probably something to talk about in another podcast, but this was something that always confused me. I used to listen to James White, who's a Reformed Baptist, and I learned a lot from his kind of methodology as far as his kind of ability to break down arguments and debate. And so I'm really thankful for that. But as an Arminian listener, I would always find it strange that on one hand, he would talk about determinism, that God has sort of ordained and decreed everything that would take place. But then when it came to, he would also say, well, we're really talking about the spiritual ability of the unregenerate person to trust and love God. God has to save them. And so it seemed to me that he would sort of talk around both sides of his mouth, but I don't think that's really relevant to this conversation, but I think it would be fun to like maybe engage with you about that, maybe off camera a little bit, because I think it is a complicated, there's sort of a complicated theology there that maybe not all non-Calvinists fully understand what you guys are getting at.
Yeah, I don't know how much, I've never been a listener of James White. I'm vaguely familiar with some of his work, but yeah, it would be interesting to find out if you thought the way I understand it would match what you've heard from him or not. But yeah, we'll have to talk about it some more.
Okay.
Well, speaking of, you brought up Stephen Wolfe's mm-hmm. Christian nationalism, and I think his views are something like a bastardized or distorted version of civil establishment of Reformed religion. Sometimes it's referred to as national confessionalism. The Covenanters, other Reformed Presbyterians, continue to hold to this, and as originally confessed in the Reformed churches. And he throws in, you know, besides his distortion of it in some way, throws in a nice dose of racialism.
Yeah, that's I'd argue that's sort of the nationalism component, that it doesn't take long for nationalism to resolve into ethnocentrism or racialism.
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks for that feedback. I think one thing I'd probably push back on just a little bit is that it wasn't only the violent segment of Anabaptists that the magisterials took issue with. So I agree that, you know, for example, Luther is primarily known in connection with the Anabaptists for his opposition to the Peasants' Revolt, and he encouraged the state to use violence to break that down, which my understanding is he maybe had some regrets about that after the fact. But so like the Lutheran Augsburg Confession rejects Anabaptist views of church-state separation. Calvin wrote his treatise against the Anabaptists that was largely in opposition to the pacifists' Anabaptist Schleitheim Confession. And Zwingli sold out his followers who became pacifist Anabaptists. He called them dangerous extremists. He saw them as threatening state approval for his movement. And he didn't object when they were executed. But as you said, the magisterial reformers were neither pacifists nor believers in the separation of church and state as we would conceive of it today. So it's kind of just maybe a fine point of disagreement. But I guess what I'd like to see if you can do is make me more optimistic about the compatibility of Reformed Christianity with libertarianism, because I'm a little bit skeptical. I think that there's just enough theocracy and intermingling of church and state there that makes me feel So you're a Reformed Christian yourself. Can you summarize briefly what it means to you to be a Reformed Christian?
Sure. What it means to me to be Reformed is, in a way, how I think it's also objectively defined. To be a Reformed Christian means to be a Christian who's confessionally Reformed, that is, who affirms a historical statement of faith or doctrinal standard confessed by a Reformed church as a summary of the Bible's main teaching. So, for example, there's the three forms of unity, as they're called, the Belgic Confession, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Canons of Dort. There's the Second Helvetic Confession. There's the Westminster Confession and Catechisms, larger and shorter catechisms. There's also the very similar Congregationalist Savoy Declaration and Second London Baptist Confession. And these aren't just a matter of doctrine in a narrow sense, but also of piety and practice. That is, those or related statements, they also reflect a view of the worship and spirituality, or the Christian life and ethics, and what it is to be and live together as Christ's church. And I would say one of the most important implications of a Reformed view of living as a Christian has to do with the religious non-neutrality of all areas of life, what might be called a worldview that's informed by a Reformed perspective. So in this sense, for me, being Reformed also means being a neo-Calvinist, but not all confessionally Reformed people would identify as neo-Calvinist.
Yeah, no, I'll ask you what that means here in a few minutes. So real quickly, one of the confessions you mentioned was the Second London Baptist Confession. So you wouldn't have a problem saying that Baptists, Reformed Baptists, are properly Reformed, even though they reject certain aspects of traditional Reformed theology, just as an example.
Well, I don't mind so much using the term. They have a different understanding of covenant theology and of course, different view of the sacraments, or at least baptism. So not properly Reformed, but we can call them particular or Calvinistic Baptists, and they're confessional in their own way, coming out of the same stream of the Reformation in England. But yeah, I don't make too much of a fuss about using that term.
Okay.
Between us, in discussion with them, I might not use it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll keep that a secret between us. So I got an alarm going off. So you mentioned the differences in, worship and spirituality. So maybe just kind of quickly, how might a Reformed approach to worship and spirituality contrast with a more typical evangelical approach? I'm kind of trying to sort of just get a broad sense here of what it means to be Reformed. So somebody who isn't Reformed could sort of, if they were to maybe jot down on paper a few things, they could distinguish it.
Yes, I think I tend to think of a difference between classical liturgical Protestantism, what you might find in a Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed congregation, where there's a pattern of worship structured around, for example, confession of sin and absolution, reading and preaching portions of Scripture, then congregational prayer and confession of faith, then the Lord's Supper, and these being interspersed with traditional hymns and or biblical psalms, or I should say biblical psalms and or traditional hymns. A contrast between that and contemporary approach, where there's basically an extended period of singing, often in a pop concert style, followed by some kind of practical or inspirational talk. And the Reformed differ from other classical liturgical traditions in we make a big deal about lacking outward pageantry. So there's no candles, no special lighting, no incense or smoke, no images or dazzling visuals, no bells or sound effects, no special clothes or decorations.
So it's not fun then. It's just, it's austere.
Yeah, the old Puritan whitewashed building maybe. And it's according to what we call the regulative principle. So it only includes those elements or categories of action in worship that we think have clear biblical warrant for New Testament worship after the apostles' time. And so no dances or puppet shows or videos or charismatic healings or prophecies, no altar calls. We try to emphasize not the individual's current subjective experience, but rather a focus on God's objective historical works in Scripture on a sinner's behalf. I don't know if that really gives a picture. You might have to attend a Reformed service to get a better idea, but I don't know. That's a description.
Yeah, no funny business.
Right, no funny business. No inappropriate levity, hopefully.
Yeah. So that's kind of what it might look like in a Reformed church. But I still think, you know, thinking about somebody who's listening who wants to distinguish what a Reformed church does, or sorry, what Reformed people believe, I guess. What are some of the central ideas that the confessions you mentioned proclaim that are maybe a little bit more unique to Reformed Christianity, stuff you wouldn't find in Methodist churches or Episcopal churches or, you know, Baptist churches? Not non-Reformed Baptist churches.
Yeah, most famously, I think the Reformed hold to the Augustinian view. We would also say the Pauline and biblical view of, or the doctrine of God's absolute sovereignty in all things, including his sovereign predestinating grace and salvation. So listeners might be interested in looking at the Second Council of Orange in 529 that might challenge their own views about these things. But probably the majority of Protestants have abandoned this position that the Reformed faith maintains.
Which, to be clear, was basically the Magisterial Reformation's position. So Lutherans, Zwingli might distinguish it all differently. And it's even developed a little bit after Calvin. You know, Beza and other folks come in and sort of, you know, systematize it a little bit. But largely speaking, the Protestant position was a predestination kind of viewpoint, right? Until the Arminians come in. Although, with the exception of the Anabaptists, who are not really part of the Magisterial Reformation.
Yeah, I guess largely the case. But what's probably the most unique, but at the same time, maybe the least well-known feature of Reformed Christianity is its robust theology of covenants. So a Reformed covenant theology relates to every point of Reformed doctrine, I'd say, even if it's not stated as explicitly in the earlier Belgic Confession, for example, but comes out more later in the Westminster Confession. If listeners are interested in finding out more about Reformed covenant theology, I'll give you some links. I recommend an ongoing series on Reformed covenant theology by a friend of mine, Charles Lee Irons. He's pastor of Santa Clarita United Reformed Church in California. So he's got a Friday night academy he's doing that's been really good so far. There's a book called Sacred Bond. I don't think it's on Amazon, or maybe the ebook's on Amazon. But anyway, by a couple guys named Brown and Keel. We understand covenant to be a sworn commitment or an oath-bound commitment, either unilateral or mutual, from one party to another, between individuals or groups. This is like a special kind of contract where an oath to or from the divine is made or implied. There can be covenants between humans, such as marriage, or between God and humans or other creatures. And in addition to the particular divine covenants in the Bible, in which God himself is one of the swearing parties, such as the second Noahic covenant in Genesis 9, that God makes with all of creation to not destroy the world again by a flood, but to preserve it, which we call the common grace covenant. There are three theological categories of covenants. So the first is there's an eternal pactum salutis, that's the Latin, or eternal covenant of redemption between the persons of the Trinity to save some of fallen humanity. The second is covenant, there's a covenant of works between God and humanity as represented in Adam to either everlastingly reward obedience, which he didn't do, or to everlastingly condemn because of disobedience. Then there's the covenant of grace between Christ and the church, saving those who have faith in him, first revealed in Genesis 3 and more fully in the Abrahamic covenant and fulfilled in the new covenant or the gospel. One of the main points of contrast, I would say, with this Reformed view of covenant theology and other views is how the Old Covenant, or the Old Testament rather, is understood to relate to the New Testament, and particularly the relation of the Old Mosaic Covenant to the New Covenant. So one popular modern view known as dispensationalism tends to view God's purpose and plan for salvation of the Israelites basically as a different kind, as basically different from his salvation and purposes for the New Covenant Church.
Just breaking really quickly, so the dispensationalists are at least, you know, there's you know, scales or differences here, you know, among dispensationalists. But if I were to kind of do a continuum, the kind of radical dispensationalist viewpoint is that those in the Old Testament are saved by something different. They're saved by keeping the law, and those in the New Covenant are saved by grace, whereas those who are covenant theologians like yourself, they would sort of see that God has really made one covenant of grace that applies to the Old Covenant believers and the New Covenant believers, that everyone is really saved by grace. And
right.
And as a result of that, there, I would say there also tends to be what you have, what gets called replacement theology. Dispensationalists say that Jews have an important purpose in God's plans, whereas those who are at least on the far side of the covenant view would sort of kind of smush that together and say, well, the church has kind of replaced Israel in a sense. Israel's, those, you know, that old, you know, group doesn't really matter anymore. It's really about who believes in Christ. So we're, the church is Israel largely. And so that's kind of at least the more extreme covenant viewpoint. So is that at least, you may not be far to that end, but you're at least closer to that than you are the dispensationalist viewpoint. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the term replacement theology is something of a criticism. So it's people who aren't coming from a covenantal perspective that say, oh, you're replacing Israel with the church. But we really see it as there's an organic connection with the people. There's one people of God throughout history. So from the time of the fall into sin in Eden, when God promises a future seed of the woman who would crush the serpent, there's been a unity in God's plan, a single plan of salvation in Jesus Christ for Jews and non-Jews alike in the one covenant of grace. It also contrasts, I'd say, the Reformed covenant theology that I would promote, contrasts perhaps with many so-called theonomists, probably some Christian nationalists who claim to be Reformed. A more consistent Reformed covenant view, in, I think, would contrast with their view, where they fail to recognize a number of important implications for the end of the Old Covenant. So, for example, how common grace plays out in the New Covenant era. That's perhaps a whole nother discussion. So we talked about it some on the podcast.
Yeah. Hey everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podthrop Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's a really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
So that's interesting because to me, you know, I think there's, even if as you say, there are distinctions that you can make between sort of your view, which you think is sort of a more traditional reform view, and what the theonomists, the Christian nationalists are saying, certainly there's at least something that's more organic that a Christian nationalist or theonomist can tap into a covenant view more easily than they can a dispensationalist view. Because a dispensationalist would say, well, the old covenant stuff, that's with Israel, the land promises, all that stuff, that's in the past. We're not there anymore. We're in this grace period now. Whereas someone who sees continuity between Israel and the church can sort of more easily use that to sort of tap into that and say, okay, well, that means that we should be instituting the law of Moses in the nations where we are today if we're Christian.
Right. That's kind of the move they're making. And unfortunately, I think what they end up doing is denying, a lot of them deny the distinctions between the three different covenant categories that I mentioned. So it causes a lot of problems in their theology. So, you know, if we talked about continuity versus discontinuity, yes, they hold to more continuity than dispensationalists, right. But I think they get a lot of the continuity wrong. So okay.
That's interesting. Okay. So go on. I apologize.
No, it's fine.
So that's good, I guess. I'm still wondering a little bit. So just, I don't know if, would you be able to elucidate just a little bit when you talk about the role of common grace? Because what is it that you see that sort of breaks up what the theonomists are trying to do?
Well, Jacob Winograd, who I'll probably mention again in another topic, he and I did a episode on his podcast, the Biblical Anarchy podcast. I forget which number it was, which episode, but on the discussing the conquest of Canaan and whether that's,
I've heard that one.
Yeah, proposes some kind of challenge to Christian libertarian anarchism. And the main idea is that particularly after the flood, when God institutes common grace, this is temporarily suspended in its normal operation during the period of the old Mosaic covenant and comes back into play with the new covenant. So what a lot of theonomist types fail to appreciate is the unique and temporary and symbolic nature. We called it the eschatological intrusionary character, which might need some explanation. But in any case, it was a special temporary symbol of the old covenant. That covenant ends with the new covenant, and that whole model goes away and common grace comes back into play in sort of the pre-Mosaic operation. And so that's something that I think they fail to appreciate that's really significant for understanding politics in the New Covenant era.
So tell me if I'm summing this up correctly, because I think this is what I think you're saying, is that common grace, this grace that God extends to everyone, regardless of whether they're the elect or not, whether they're saved or not, is gives Reformed Christians sort of an impetus or marching order or something to extend grace to their non-Christian neighbors, and that theonomy doesn't extend that same level of grace. It sort of wants to, you know, silence or shame those people, or sort of maybe not force them to convert, but at least kind of put pressure on them to convert. And not sort of give them the freedom to make that decision? Is that something like...
Well, it has to do with God's preserving of the world order, right? So he's not going to keep bringing judgments on the whole world until the final judgment. So it's a delay of final judgment. But of course, in the old covenant, we see a miniature kind of picture of judgment, right? The Israelites go in and judge the people of the land. They devote them to destruction. Of course, they don't actually do it as they should have, but that was the idea. And during the normal operations of the common grace order, that's not how it works. So we're not bringing either final judgment or even a picture, symbolic picture of final judgment on unbelieving neighbors. Okay. There's a common endeavor in God's preservation of human society and societal order, common operation and civil governance. And that continues again in the New Covenant era. So we're not enforcing against non-aggressive immorality. So we're not enforcing, coercively enforcing religion.
Gotcha.
For example.
So you would not see the world as sort of one big Israel, but you know, distinguished in, you know, with national boundaries in a sort of a way that theonomists kind of do, right? Where it's like, well, you know, we need to sort of initiate, you know, Israelite-like Mosaic commands and all these nations. Well, that's not really the call.
Yeah, it's like their idea that when the old covenant goes away, instead of that whole model being temporary, it just gets repeated with every nation that the gospel comes to, as though God's making an old covenant with every nation now. And that's not, he's making the new covenant with every nation in terms of the church, but not in terms of the structure of God's people as a political body.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and just kind of thinking about where, like, an Anabaptist sort of fit into this. They're not dispensationalists, because that's sort of something that comes later, but they would emphasize discontinuity more, I think. They would sort of say, they wouldn't deny the inspiration of the Old Testament, but they would sort of say that was God's covenant with Israel. That's what he did then. But, you know, we sort of live by the Sermon on the Mount and these new covenant principles and guidelines that, for example, forbid violence, which also means we stay separate from the state because the state is the monopoly on violence. And so for most Anabaptists, that ends up being separation. Whereas those, you know, I guess on the Christian nationalist side would say, because of the continuity, they understand that continuity is meaning that Christians should be heavily involved in the state. So there's a distinction there based on how much continuity or discontinuity is understood to be at play.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Reformed, my understanding of Reformed covenant theology sort of, I don't know, escapes that spectrum. It's okay. A different way of looking at it, yeah.
Okay. So could you define then what libertarianism means to you, since we're talking about reform? We've kind of defined reform to some extent. Can we define libertarianism?
Yes, and similarly, I think that what libertarianism means to me is also how I think it's objectively defined. Libertarianism is the belief in self-ownership and a certain view of property rights and the corresponding obligation of the non-aggression principle that everyone should refrain from initiating coercion against the person and property of others. And as I understand it, this belief commits me to not only the normativity of a general free market, but also to non-aggression in civil governance, which precludes the legitimacy of the state's monopoly. So that's to say, it commits me to anarchism or non-monopolist civil governance, but of course not all libertarians follow that through. So some are minarchists, we'd say. Yeah.
Yeah. So, real quick, this is, I don't know if this is something that you've said, but you can tell me if you think this sort of lines up with what you're thinking. To me, part of the sort of question about what the state should be doing that Christian nationalists, I don't think carefully enough through, is that I don't see anywhere in the Bible where pagans are expected, you know, or non-Christians will say, are expected to live by the Mosaic law or even necessarily Christian principles. There's something that we sort of call what you might call sort of common grace or that connects with common grace. But this idea of natural law, that there are sort of these guidelines about how all human beings are supposed to treat each other. And that, you know, the law of Moses is a little different in some ways because this is a special covenant community of God. And the church also has obligations that might actually rise above natural law. So whereas natural law might say, don't do unto others what you don't want done to you, Christians are called to do unto others what we would have them do unto us, right? And so it's a higher standard. But what libertarianism seems to, I think, maybe reflect very well this idea of natural law, how humans are expected to treat each other in nature. We're not supposed to hurt each other, initiate force against each other, steal from each other. And that when that does happen, it's reasonable and acceptable for, you know, non-Christian, we'll say, you know, for nations, for societies to sort of say, okay, well, we're going to have systems in place that can punish those who aggress on others. And that's sort of the purpose of, you know, civil authority as we
think
of it.
I don't know how you would think about this, but I would put it somewhat differently. I wouldn't say that there's a higher or different standard of morality for unbelievers. Even in natural law, so to speak, I think the standard is the same. So it's still obligatory on non-Christians, on unbelievers, to worship the only true and living God through Jesus Christ. So the you know, the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. as that embodies morality from creation onwards, and Christ not giving a different set of moral obligations, but the new law as it's focused in him, right, in the ethic of love. So we understand that to be the moral obligations on everyone. But that's not to say that God has ordained civil governance as a particular societal function to coercively enforce morality in its fullness. Only, rather, we think, civil justice, which is restricted to enforcing against aggression against persons, other persons and their property. So we just limit our understanding of civil governance rather than sort of bifurcate moral obligation. So I don't know if that would be compatible with your understanding, but that's kind of how I've.
Yeah. So let me say, I'm not saying that pagans are not expected to convert, or that there's no moral obligation to turn and repent and worship Jesus. I guess what I'm saying is that the guidelines by which nation civil authority is expected to function by is not the same guideline as the Sermon on the Mount, for example. It's a different guideline.
So yes, I think that's right.
Yeah. So God judges civil authorities not by how well they make everybody keep the Sabbath, but by whether or not they are creating conditions in which there can be sort of peace and freedom and the enforcement of, we'll say, the silver rule.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So let's see here. So as much as I think Anabaptist Christianity is maybe at least more consistent with libertarianism than Reformed Christianity is, I don't by any means want to discourage the Reform from considering libertarianism. I want to get as many people into that boat as I can. So what I'd like to see is kind of a strong case built for libertarianism from a Reformed perspective. So here's, I guess, what I'd like to ask you. In light of what the early Reformers taught about church and state, which you, you know, acknowledged and discussed as well, how can you consistently call yourself a Reformed Christian and a libertarian? Are there significant Reformed theologians who support your viewpoint? You mentioned neo-Calvinism. I don't know if that plays in at all. Or as a Protestant, you just kind of get to play the get-out-of-jail-free card of sola scriptura, scripture alone, and say, well, Calvin is wrong about this one and the Bible's right, but I'm still more or less basically Reformed.
Well, it's fairly simple, I think. And we may say this, I'm pretty sure we say this in one of the episodes of the Reformed Libertarians podcast, if no Reformed church had corrected its confessional position on the question of civil establishment of religion, then as libertarians, we couldn't say that we were Reformed in that respect. But thank God, not long after the Westminster Confession was written in 1646, not only did the Reformed Congregationalists revise their confession on that point, along with the particular Baptists, so did the American Presbyterians. We revised our confession on that point of civil establishment of religion, at least since 1729, officially in 1788, they rewrote their confession on those sections. And some of the Dutch and other Reformed followed suit in the late 1800s. And Abraham Kuyper, one of the founders of Neo-Calvinism in the late 1800s, basically said it was inevitable, in his view, that the Reformed churches would eventually disavow establishmentarianism or the civil establishment of religion, because it was at odds. That doctrine arose from principles at odds with the Reformed faith. I've written an article on Reformed disestablishmentarianism entitled Against Civil Establishment of Religion. You can find that at the Reformed Libertarians website. Listeners might be interested in that article.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and put links to any articles or books that you mentioned in the what those in the industry, podcasting industry, call the show notes.
The show notes.
Right. So, on neo-Calvinism, can you clarify that a little bit? Is that Kuyper's viewpoint, you said?
Yes. The movement following from him and some of his colleagues. Now, it's not to be confused with what's been called new Calvinism. That's something else altogether. But neo-Calvinism has two basic elements. It's a reformed theological response to beliefs and conditions that developed largely since the end of the 1600s, including, for example, theological issues raised by modern sciences and philosophies. And neo-Calvinism isn't just the development or application of theology, but it's also the articulation of a reformed or Calvinistic comprehensive worldview based on or understood through the perspective of reformed Christian beliefs. So one of the key ideas of neo-Calvinism is called societal sphere sovereignty, which is an elaboration on the idea that society is not a single thing, but is distinct kinds of relations and different kinds of communities that each have their own God-given nature and authority and should therefore be free from interference from other kinds of authority, especially free from civil government's interference. And I've written a paper on that. I talked about that also with Jacob Winograd of the Biblical Anarchy podcast. You can find a clip of it. I've posted on YouTube. But I should also say, in reference to Calvin, in some respects, the Reformed churches never followed parts of his view of civil governance in their confessions. So Calvin's specific theology isn't and never was the standard for what is Reformed. I mean, Calvinist is a nickname. So it's not, Calvin's own theology is not the standard. The church's confessions are the standard for what's Reformed. And in the same way, like Augustine's own specific theology could never trump the church creeds, for example. But listeners might be interested, as far as other Reformed thinkers, listeners might be interested in the Reformed Political Resistance Annotated Bibliography. I'll give you a link for that. So in addition to the revised confessions, these Reformed thinkers and the bibliography, they were not libertarians as such, but they support the element of political resistance on a Reformed basis that effectively allows for Reformed libertarianism.
So one thing that sort of occurs to me as I listen to your kind of explanations of these things, is that to one extent, you know, we use words to define things, and we even can define things that are a little bit hazy. So what it means to be reformed could be, you know, following these confessions or, and that's largely, I guess, the sort of understand these confessions sort of dictate what reformed ideology is. But as you said, you know, the confessions have been adapted at times and have been modified. And so there's Protestants in general, maybe are at a certain disadvantage in defining ourselves compared to, for example, Catholics, because Roman Catholicism is a magisterial religion in that, like, you know, you have an authority structure who says, this is what it is, we can point to it. And so if you disagree on those, on any of those points, you're not a Catholic, or at least you're not thinking Catholicly. Whereas it seems to me that it's very possible that the Christian nationalists, for example, could tap into all these reformed thinkers and ideas and confessions and still perhaps have a legitimate claim to be reformed. But on the other hand, if that's true, you could also argue that since some of these confessions have been, you know, modified to not necessarily require church and state, you know, commingling, and also because you have, you know, legitimate Calvinist reformed thinkers who are very influential, like Kuyper, you can also make an argument for kind of a foundation for libertarian type of reformed thinking that's not, you know, Christian nationalist or theonomist. Do you feel like what I'm saying there is fair, or do you feel like in a very real sense that can be quantified, those who are like theonomists or Christian nationalists are not legitimately reformed, or do you feel like is it kind of a big tent, or what do you think about that?
So I parse it out a little bit this way. I say there is the historical doctrine of civil establishment of religion. But that goes back to Theodosius. That's not particular to the Reformed faith. And I would agree with Kuyper that idea of civil establishment of religion came into Christian doctrine based on principles that are not Reformed, that are unreformed, that are at odds with the Reformed faith. So that's what I say about the embodiment of civil establishment of religion in the earlier Reformed confessions, that it was taking in something alien to the Reformed faith. And if the theonomists and Christian nationalists were making that historical argument based on the original Reformed understanding of that view, that might be an improvement. That might give them a better pedigree for their own beliefs, but they're not even doing that. They're making novel constructions of their understanding of the relationship between church and state and society.
So I we're closing on an hour, so I don't want to drag anything out too much, but I want to make sure I understand some of the stuff, because it seems to me that establishment principle is in Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. So you could argue that it's there from the beginning, that some of these later confessions, as they are sort of, you know, revising some of the stuff, that their position is the later position. What I would say is, from an Anabaptist perspective, that I don't think the magisterial reformers went back far enough. They said sola scriptura, and they went back as far as Augustine and said that's good enough. And so I agree that, you know, they're not inventing establishment. That's part of this Christian tradition that developed, you know, a few hundred years after Jesus and became sort of marked the Western Church and the East in a different way. But so, you know, I would be, you know, I'm not Reformed, but I would almost be more inclined to say, you know, I think Kuyper better retrieved biblical principles than Calvin did. That he's within this Reform stream, but maybe he got it right in a way that maybe the earliest reformers didn't.
Yeah, I think Kuyper properly stands on Calvin's shoulders. So there couldn't have been a Kuyper without Calvin. Sure. But particularly on civil governance, Calvin gets it wrong.
So maybe just really quickly, could you tell me how Kuyper, you said Kuyper's made the argument that those who believed in establishmentarianism, that they were getting the Reformed faith wrong. What is his sort of standard? What is his argument for why his view is more Reformed?
Well, I go into it in the article that I mentioned against civil establishment of religion.
Okay.
And actually, I'm pulling out more from Charles Hodge. Charles Hodge makes, of course, Kuyper wrote and spoke in Dutch. I think Hodge makes the more concise, explicit biblical argument. So that's why I appeal to Hodge, but in that article. But I think Kuyper says very similar things. So if you looked at that, you'd get it in that article. And essentially, it's a kind of exclusion argument saying that in the establishment of the new covenant, we don't get the representation of the duty of civil governance to be the enforcement of religion. If the scriptures had wanted to make that clear in terms of the new covenant, it would have. And it actually specifies the duty of enforcement of religion, though not coercively, but rather spiritually and persuasively and morally, to the church. So it's the church's duty to propagate true religion, and therefore not the duty of civil governance. That's something of the reasoning. So take a look at the article.
Great.
Well, but people can contact me if they have questions about it, I guess.
And real quick, as somebody who has in the past tried to Google Kuyper after hearing him referenced in audio materials, I'm just going to say that his name is spelled Kuyper. So if someone's listening and saying, how the heck do I Google this guy?
Kuyper.
I can't learn anything about it.
Yeah, it's the U-Y.
Yeah. That's the, I guess he was Dutch. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Yep.
No, so anyway, so it's a different pronunciation, I suppose. So because we're closing in an hour, I had other questions I want to ask, but I might skip around just a little bit if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay. So I'd sent you some questions ahead of time. So if you had any notes on here, we could jump to maybe question 10. So my question there, I have to admit that, you know, my Anabaptist leaning views are not also a perfect fit for libertarianism, since libertarianism is essentially a view about what the political realm ought to look like, whereas Anabaptists have largely been separationists. They want to keep the state and church separate. And because of that, a lot of Anabaptists are almost sort of neutral about the state, right? It's like, well, that's another realm. We don't really care what it looks like. Anabaptists also, I think, reject violence out of hand, whereas a libertarian order would at least acknowledge the right to individual and organized self-defense and would even seek to build a society where the fear of responsive violence is a deterrent for aggression. And so just to kind of expose myself a little bit, I was going to, if I have sort of a question, maybe a softball question for you, you can sort of, you know, get the knife in. Might these be areas where the Magisterial Reformation is more consistent with libertarian thought than Anabaptism?
Yeah, I guess I would basically agree. I would say that's the case. Insofar as the Reformed view affirms the legitimacy of proportional, responsive, defensive, and restitutionary coercion, which includes the legitimacy of civil governance, the administration of civil justice according to God-given norms, by proportional responsive coercion, which is the only legitimate use of coercion. And this can involve coercively enforcing restitution by aggressors to their victims. In that way, Reform view, I'd say, is more consistent with libertarianism than any form of pacifism, which seems to say that no use of coercion can be just or moral. I don't really take pacifism seriously, but I guess I'd say it's a better view, it's a better erroneous view to hold than any view that promotes the enormities of the state.
Greg, you've hurt me deeply. To jump to another question here. Let's see here. Let's start with 12, or actually go to 12. Is there common ground that Christians of all backgrounds can point to in order to build a Christian case for libertarianism? What is it that we're working with that we can all sort of agree on, whether we like Calvin or Kuyper or you know, the Swiss Anabaptists or whatever?
Yeah, Well, of course, it depends on what one might take to be a genuinely ecumenical Christian belief. And I think all Christians should affirm free will and our moral culpability before God. But I don't actually think that that belief really does much for political theory as such, as some people might think. The belief in God's sole absolute sovereignty, I think, gets us somewhere politically. I think it entails some things for political theory, but that's not often taken as an ecumenical Christian belief.
So really quickly, if God is, and the Reformed view really emphasizes God's sovereignty, but if God is sovereign king, then to hold to, you know, the sovereignty of humans is in a sense a challenge to God's sovereignty.
Yeah, exactly. The belief in God's absolute sovereignty necessarily inherently relativizes and limits all human authority. So that's the main idea. And that plays out in specific ways. But I also mentioned in an interview with Chris Spangle on the Chris Spangle Show, Carrie and I did that interview together. I think that a proper view of Reformed covenant theology goes a long way in some of the ways I mentioned about the understanding of common grace coming back into play in its normal operation in the new covenant era. And so I can send you a link for that interview. And whether that's something that non-Reformed Christians could accommodate, a kind of understanding of common grace in the new covenant era, I couldn't really say, but I definitely recommend it. And in that same interview with Spangle, I also mentioned three things that many Christian libertarians seem to agree on as urging libertarianism. So the first is the sixth and eighth commandments, as we reckon them, do not murder, do not steal, as entailing self-ownership and property rights. The second would be Jesus's moral imperative to treat others as you would be treated, that entailing a non-aggressionist and non-vengeance, non-retaliation ethic. And I think the third would be the Bible's consistent portrayal of centralized power in a negative light. So those three principles, I think there may be others, but at least I've noticed that those tend to be the key ones that we've rallied around so far.
Yeah, and they're all biblical principles. So they're
that's right,
rooted in, there's something that all Protestants should affirm, but also even Catholics and Eastern Orthodox should be able to say, well, okay, yeah, I guess you're right. All right, so I think that's a good starting point for building an ecumenical Christian libertarianism. So I'm glad that we're both on that team, even if our unique confessional commitments are different. I'm also glad that the Anabaptist insistence on freedom from religious coercion won out in the West, or else this would have been a very different conversation. Greg, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me. As a reminder, where can folks find you?
I have most of my stuff at Linktree, so I'll send you that. It has my bio, a link to reformedlibertarians.com. That's the podcast website. Got YouTube and other resource links. You know, I should give Norman Horn credit on those three points. Back in 2014, he had given a presentation where I think he pretty much lays those out. So we'll put that in the show notes too. And I am also happy to be on the same team with you, Cody. So thanks for the good questions, fair engagement. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. And I hope listeners will feel free to contact me by email, which you can find on my bio, and keep your eye out for Carrie Baldwin and my forthcoming free ebook, which at the moment is entitled Key Elements of Reformed Libertarianism.
Yeah, and also mentioned, I've had Carrie Baldwin on this podcast once before as well, and she made a case for kind of pro-life position from an anarchist point of view, which is an interesting conversation. somewhat dense. So be ready to take a notebook and a pencil. But so it's a good conversation. All right. Thank you so much, Craig. I really appreciate you taking time to be here to talk with us.
Thank you, Cody.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.